what you'd like to hear. I think it's a good idea, since most of us, or a lot of us, tend to take ourselves too seriously, maybe to start out with a little humor here. How about a little Book of Mormon humor? There was a Mormon soldier in World War II that carried a Book of Mormon in his front pocket. And he was on the front line. He got shot one day by a German. And this small Book of Mormon saved his life, which goes to show that not even a German bullet can get through Second Nephi. I think you, many of you know what we're talking about there. This is Brad's joke. He's the one handing out the papers for me. He says the Muslims do not recognize Christians or Jews, and the Christians do not recognize Jews or Muslims, and the Jews don't recognize Christians or Muslims, and the Mormons don't recognize each other in a liquor store. So I got to tell you a story on Lou Wagner. He's the president of this organization, but sometimes he loses it. He came to southern Utah a few years ago, and he and I went deer hunting. And we'd been hunting all day, and we just didn't have any luck. And so toward the afternoon, we came to this ranch that was posted, no trespassing. And I said to Lou, I know who owns this ranch. As a matter of fact, we used to work in the church together years ago, and I think if I ask him, he would let us hunt on this ranch, and we get a deer in here. You say in the pickup truck, I'll go talk to my friend here, see if he'll let us do this. So I went in the house and talked to my old friend, and he said, oh, sure, sure. He says, you're welcome to hunt on my ranch. But he says, I'd like to ask a favor of you. He says, I've got an old, sick horse that the veterinarian says there's no hope for it. But he says, I love that horse. We've been through so much together. He says, I just can't kill it. He says, if you'll kill it, I can bury it. I said, sure, I'll do that for you. So I figure I'm going to have a little fun with Lou. So I go out to the truck and I say to Lou, this guy just kicked us off his property. He's threatened to have us arrested for trespassing. I'm so damn mad, I'm going to kill that horse. So I took my rifle and I killed that horse. Lou says, I'm just as mad as you are, and killed a couple of cows. Well, I think we need to get started then on the post-Mormon feelings. What are some of the feelings that you have after leaving Mormonism? Hopefully everybody has a handout that says post-Mormon feelings on it. Does everybody have that? You know? Okay. We need one down here, Brad. Slide right here. What happens to a person when they finally come to the conclusion that Mormonism is in fact based on deception? The first feeling that I experienced was one of fear. What's going to happen to me if I acknowledge this, if I go ahead with this? pardon me. Will I lose my family? Will my wife leave me? And even if she doesn't, will she be angry and upset with me? What about my children? What about my brothers and my sister? They'll all be very angry. They're all very active in the church. What will happen when my children or grandchildren decide to get married in the temple and I can't go? Or they have their children blessed and I can't go up in the circle. What's going to happen to me? I'm going to be very embarrassed and it's going to be really hard on me and my family. What about my job? I was teaching at a university in southern Utah that's 90% Mormons. Will I lose my job? Well, these are some of the things that the first feelings that I had. And what if I'm wrong? My brothers are all just as smart as I am. Why don't they see this? Why doesn't my sister see this? Deception and these problems. What if I'm wrong? I'm jeopardizing my eternal soul here. I'm playing for big money here with this. What if I've made a mistake? Do I dare trust my own thinking? So fear keeps many people in the church, keeps many people from asking questions. I know a woman who went to get a temple recommend, and her sick president said, "Where's your husband?" She said, "He doesn't believe in the church anymore." And the sick president said, "Why not?" She said, "Well, he started reading a lot of things into church history, and he decided that it wasn't true anymore." And the sick president said to her, "I know what you mean." He said, "I started reading that, and I almost lost my testimony. I had to quit reading it." So here was an admission that he couldn't do any research into church history. He was about to lose his testimony. So a question might be asked, what would you and I do if it weren't for fear? If we had no fear in our lives, what action would we take? Okay, the first my feelings then were fear. The second one was sadness. Sadness. Yeah, bereavement. This is a very painful thing to go through. For me, it was even more painful than losing my parents, to realize that I had devoted my life to something. And my belief in this was dying. So it's just devastating. The truth not only hurts, it's devastating. It can be devastating. Well, do people show sympathy for a person who's going through this bereavement? No. What emotions are you likely to get from family and friends? Anger, right? There's no sympathy for you. You're a bad person. And so, as hard as it is to be a widow, you get a lot of people giving you support and feeling sorry for you and taking care of you, but you don't hear. You get anger from people, which makes it even more difficult. The next emotion that I felt was confusion. It turned my world upside down. I'd always been proud of going on a mission. And suddenly I realized that I'd spent 2 years telling people things that were not true. And not only that, I had helped break up a number of families. At the time, I felt it was okay because anything can be sacrificed for God or the truth. But quite often, both people don't convert. Often, more often I found, at least, it was the woman who converted to the church. And in a number of occasions, it ended in a divorce. I broke up a lot of families. So you think Mormonism is family-oriented? The heck it is. I feel real sad about that. I used to be proud that I was going to the temple. I'm not proud of that anymore. I'm ashamed of the fact that I was married in the temple, and my younger brother, who I loved, who was only about 12 years old, couldn't come and see me get married. Mormon marriage is not a family celebration. It's a church power situation. And a number of my friends were not active in the church. They couldn't come and see me get married. People that I really wanted to attend, a lot of them were excluded here. I'm ashamed of that. Why didn't I say to hell with you? I'm going to get married where my family and my friends and people can come and see this and celebrate this wedding. I was really proud of that. I'm not anymore. I was proud of paying my tithing. But now I realize that a very small percentage of tithing goes to help the poor. You get a lot of publicity. They send a plane load of something over here or there. But what percentage of that is the church income? They're spending $1.5 billion to remodel a block right here in Salt Lake City. All new stores. When was the last time they gave $1.5 billion to charity? So I'm not that proud that I used to be of paying my tithing. I'm not proud of the fact that I went to BYU and graduated. The professors there have to swallow their consciences in many cases. I know a number of BYU professors. Being a professor myself, I mingled with a bunch of them, and there's a lot of them that don't believe in Mormonism. They don't dare say so. They'll lose their jobs. They have to pay their tithing. They have to go in and be interviewed by their bishops, or they can't work there. And also the people who work in the church office buildings over here. If they have doubts, they have to keep their mouth shut here. And so you have a world that is turned upside down, at least I did. And that's kind of fearful. And then after that, you come to anger. You feel betrayed and entrapped. How do I get out of this? Some people dwell on this. I know a man in St. George that has let his anger virtually destroy his life. He became so bitter that his wife couldn't live with him anymore. So he's living alone. He talks about killing people. He can't do that, so he turns his anger inward, and now he has physical problems. You turn your anger inward, and it destroys your health. So he's a very sick person right now, a very bitter person, and nobody likes him. Nobody likes a bitter, angry person. So this anger has to be controlled. But on the other hand, if you don't have a little bit of anger, then nobody thinks you're serious. You couldn't really be serious about this. You're not upset enough. And if you get upset, then you're a bitter person. So how are you supposed to handle that one? So it's important, I think, to have a little bit of anger. Without anger, we wouldn't have had the Boston Tea Party, would we? We wouldn't have had the Declaration of Independence. They were angry. They dumped that tea in the harbor. We wouldn't have had the slaves free if the abolitionists hadn't gotten angry. And so a lot of good things have come out of anger. And so I think you need a little bit of anger, but maybe not too much. So that's kind of a hard one to work on. After the anger, the feelings of betrayal, you work your way through that to a feeling of happiness, freedom, exhilaration. We've heard several people in our conference talk about how great it feels to be free, to be able to read anything they want to read, to do their own thinking, to choose their own underwear. My gosh, you don't realize until you get out how confined and how controlled you were. So that would be the, hopefully, the positive aspect of this. And I think someone has suggested that the more deeply you are involved in Mormonism, the more free you feel when you get out. And I've talked to people who were recent converts who decided to get out who haven't felt any anger at all and haven't felt the freedom that comes with that. But when you're taught Mormonism in the crib, I remember the first prayers I offered as a three-year-old were for President Heber J. Grant. And when you're raised that way, and it's every breath you breathe, and it's a whole life of your family, it's different than if you're a recent convert. And so I think the more deeply you're into it, the more freedom you feel when you get out. Which brings us here to the subject of freedoms. You're free to have a cup of coffee if you want it, or a glass of wine, or a bottle of beer. You're free one more day each week to do as you please, instead of being having to do what you're supposed to do every Sunday. You have an increase in family income between 10% and 30%, depending on if you're sending out a missionary or whatever else you're doing. And chances are that frees one of you up. You don't have to work an extra job. The wife doesn't have to go to work necessarily. I know a guy in St. George who doesn't believe in the church at all. And he took a second job to send his daughter on a mission. That's really power. He'd do it for his daughter. He didn't. He did it for the church. And when she came back, she got married in the temple, and he couldn't even see his own daughter get married, because he wasn't willing to go in and lie and say, yeah, I believe in all this. And so that's the kind of stuff that we're dealing with here. You have a freedom from guilt. Oh, man, the guilt. I used to say that religion is in the forgiveness business. Just like General Motors is in the automobile business, or IBM's in the computer business. And so, if people don't feel guilty, religion is out of business. They got to make you feel guilty. So, they come up with a lot of rules about what you can and can't wear, what you can and can't eat, what you can and can't say, what shows you can see and can't, and what music you can listen to. And if you don't do everything just right, then you have to feel guilty. You're not doing your temple work. You're not doing genealogy. And if you're doing those, you're not singing in the choir. And if you're not doing that, then you haven't got your food storage plan done. And you haven't got your genealogy done. And you don't go to the temple often enough. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. There is no way that I know of to escape guilt in Mormonism. And that's a pretty great thing to be free from. Once you get out, you have a certain freedom from fear. It used to be when the phone would ring, I would wonder if it was the bishop calling me to be the teacher of an unruly Sunday school class or scoutmaster or whatever else job I didn't want to take. I was almost afraid to answer the phone because I didn't want to turn him down. I'd always been taught you don't turn down a call in the church. When the phone rings now, I don't care. I feel free there. So those are some of the freedoms that we feel. And ironically, we're going to move now to challenges. The first challenge on my list here is freedom. what I've just been talking about. Eric Hoffer, many of you may know his classic work, The True Believer, claims that most people do not want freedom. They don't. They want a pope, a prophet, a president, a shaman, some kind of person to tell them what to do, what to believe. They don't want to make their own decisions and take their own responsibility. They're afraid of that. I years ago had a friend who was a bishop, and maybe some of these stories will be unbelievable to you, but he said women would actually call him and say, "Bishop, do you think I should have another baby?" She wanted the bishop to decide if three kids was enough or if she should have four or five. They would ask him what activities or positions were acceptable in the bedroom. They want the bishop to regulate their sex life. They want somebody to tell them what to do. They don't want to decide on their own what to do. And so if Eric Hoffer is right, maybe most of the people that are still in the church don't want freedom. They don't want to make decisions and take responsibilities. I don't know. Maybe he's right. The second challenge that I have here on this list are family relationships. Quite a bit has been said about that in this conference. But in my opinion, this is possibly the most serious challenge that most of us face. If it weren't for family stress and pressures, as I mentioned last night, we would be having this conference in the Salt Palace. I know a lot of people that don't dare come. Don't let their wife let know they're here. Or their husband. Or their kids. Or their mother and dad. Or don't come at all because they're afraid of what the family will think or say. You have a handout called Families Held Hostage. We won't go over that right now, but that's an indication of how powerful this family thing is. Some has been said about the Colorado City young girls being married to men old enough to be their grandfathers. A lot of those young girls would leave, but they love their family. They love their mother and their brothers and sisters. And the outside world is scary. This is where they feel comfortable, is in their homes, whether they're molested or not. There's an old saying, the devil we know is not as bad as the devil we don't know. You know, what else could be out there? Maybe these other guys are worse than my dad, who's molesting me or whatever. And so they love their families. A number of people, I've read studies that indicate that a number of people could have left Germany and escaped Hitler's ovens, but they loved their families. And they couldn't all get out, so they stayed with their families and died. I don't know how many of you are aware of this, but in the Muslim religion, not only are the martyrs promised 72 virgins, if they strap a bomb around them and go bomb a bus. I was over there for a whole summer in Amman, Jordan, and we went to Syria, we went all over the place, went to a Palestinian refugee camp. And this Palestinian mother said to us, "Two of my sons have been bombers. One took out a whole bus full of Israelis, another one a restaurant," and she said, "My only regret is I don't have two more to send." What's this got to do with families? Well, some of you may not be aware that not only is a martyr entitled to go directly to Allah's garden, their version of heaven, without going through the judgment day. He goes directly to Allah's garden if he is a martyr for Islam. But he takes 70 members of his family with him. Are his brothers and sisters going to talk him out of it? They want to go there too. Is his mother going to try to talk him out of it? Or his uncles? So they use the family to create bombers over there. Suicide bombers. And their families talk them into it. They don't talk them out of it. And then they send them a big check from the government for $100,000 to build a new home or whatever. So it's no wonder that there's 30 bombings a day or whatever it is now. It's unbelievable. But the family is used to do that. Which reminds me that a story, they say that Osama bin Laden finally died and became a martyr. And he went to the pearly gates and he said to St. Peter, "I'm here for my reward." And St. Peter said, "Okay." He says, "We got your reward for you." And in walked George Washington. And just beat the hell out of him. And then it walked in Thomas Jefferson and started it on him, and Thomas Paine. And finally, when Osama was almost dead, he turns to St. Peter and says, "This isn't what I expected." St. Peter says, "We promised you 72 Virginians." Maybe that's what he ought to have, is 72 Virginians. And anyway. Another challenge for many people is their business or professional life. What's going to happen by business? I know a man in St. George that is giving our group financial help, but he won't put his name on anything, or he won't come out. He says it would hurt my business. He's a very prominent businessman. And in St. George, you don't support the Post-Mormon Support Association if you want to maintain your place in the business community. What about people who work for the church or at BYU? Are they free to... down in Colorado City, they have what is called the United Effort Plan, which has just been taken over, finally, away from Warren Jeffs by the state. But what it is that nobody owns any land. They don't own their homes. They don't own the land under their homes. It's all owned communally. It's all owned by the United Effort Plan. And if they go to priesthood meeting, if they do what they're told to do, then they get to stay in the house. But if Warren Jeffs decides that they are not obedient enough, he kicks them out. How free are you if someone else controls your livelihood, your chance to support your kids? Someone else decides whether you can be in that house today and gone tomorrow. And not only that, a few months ago, he excommunicated 30 prominent men in town and reassigned their wives and children to other men who are more obedient. 30 men kicked them right out of their houses, right out of town, took their wives away from them and their children, and reassigned them. Well, Warren Jeffs is only doing what Brigham Young did. And this is all quoted in my book. Brigham Young in, 1857, an April conference, told a congregation in the tabernacle, "I am daily sealing young girls to men of age and experience." Young girls to old men. That's what Jeffs is in trouble for, isn't it? And he would reassign John D. Lee, the infamous Mountain Meadows Massacre scapegoat, was a little hesitant to go down to the Cotton Mission, which incidentally was originally the Cotton Wine and Tobacco Mission. They had pretty good wine in Santa Clara and out in Tokerville, and they had tobacco there too, but it's now conveniently called the Cotton Mission. But at any rate, he was a little reluctant to leave the Salt Lake area and go down there. Brigham Young took his favorite wife and children and gave them to someone else. That's exactly what Warren Jeffs is doing. So how can we honor Brigham Young and condemn Warren Jeffs? I don't see how we can do that. It just doesn't add up. Well, when you have an economic system where everything is owned by the hierarchy, by the authoritarian group, it doesn't leave a person much freedom. I think basic to religious freedom, basic to political freedom, is economic freedom. I own my home. I own my business, my farm. I can sell it if I want. Nobody tells me what to do in my economic life. Freedom of enterprise. Without freedom of enterprise, you cannot have political freedom or religious freedom. And they haven't got it there, and they didn't have it in early Utah. The first United Order was organized in St. George in 1874, spread all over the state eventually. Brigham Young died in 1877, and then they decided that he was all wrong about that. The last one remaining was in Orderville over on Highway 89, but it was a very evil system, in my opinion, to put all the power in the top without individuals having their individual power. So there's the economic aspect. What will happen to my business? What will happen to my job security? What will happen to my family if I speak up, if I say anything? Then another challenge is to develop new social relationships. This is more important for some people than other people. Some people really need friends. They need people to be with and talk with. Other people are more of a recluse, and they don't like to be independent and all that. And so many people who leave the church, they feel a vacuum because they don't have their friends anymore that they used to have in Relief Society or in the priesthood quorums or something else. So some of them might join another church to get that kind of social relationship. But that's a decision or a challenge that people have to make there. How important is this? Overcoming many years of indoctrination and brainwashing is another challenge. Do you ever really get over those many years of brainwashing? I'm not sure. As sure as I am that the Book of Mormon is not authentic, and that the church leaders lied about that, and they lied about polygamy, and they lied about a lot of things, and the immoral and illegal behavior that I see in reading church history is appalling. And as sure as I am that it is not what it claims to be, if I hear, "Come, come, ye saints," or, "Oh, my Father," it still has a little bit of a tug at my heart. You know, do you ever really, or does it become part of your DNA? Does it become part of your nervous system? Or what? So there's that challenge of overcoming your childhood conditioning. Another challenge, do I speak up or just keep quiet? Now, if you keep quiet, you won't get in trouble. You are a heretic. Sterling McMurrin, who I just idolize, was the Commissioner of Education, appointed by John F. Kennedy. He was the philosophy professor at the University of Utah. Came to Southern Utah, had a ranch down there, and I had a number of talks with Sterling McMurrin, personal talks. And he said, I'm a heretic. I'm not an apostate. He said, I don't believe any of it. But he says, I keep my mouth shut. I just... So do you become an apostate and speak up, or do you are you just... Well, his idea was this, and he might be right. I have so much respect. This was a guy, I don't know how high his IQ was, But it was so high that they couldn't measure it. He could quote philosophers, his favorite was Bertrand Russell, but he could quote philosophers word for word by the hour. He could read something and memorize it as fast as he could read it. This was a genius. And this was his idea. He said that all churches are nonsense. They're all based on nonsense. And he says Mormonism is based on nonsense. Well, he says it's my nonsense, so why should I put it down? Why should I criticize it? They're all nonsense. He was an agnostic. Well, I don't know. But a person has to make that decision. I couldn't quite make that decision because I saw people really suffering. And I thought, well, if I write a book, if I talk about this, maybe I can help somebody who's going through what I went through. So, but I'm not saying I'm right. Maybe he's right. Incidentally, Sterling told me one time about when they tried to excommunicate him. His state president called him in and said, Sterling, we're just not going to put up with you anymore. We're going to excommunicate you. We're calling a trial. We're going to have a trial here for you. The word got back to President McKay. Now, this was told to me by Sterling himself. This is not hearsay. The word got back to President McKay, and President McKay called Sterling on the phone and says, what's the matter, Sterling? He says, why are they after you? Sterling says, well, he says, I don't believe, and once in a while I say so. President McKay says, well, come to my office. He says, no, he says, I'll drive out to your house. And a number of times I saw President McKay speeding around when I was going to the University of Utah, down 13th East, by himself. Yeah, he loved to do that. He was going to go out to see Sterling. He says, no, President. He says, I'll come up to your office. So he went up to President McKay's office, and President McKay said, Sterling, he says, what is it that you can't believe and still be a member of this church? He says, is it evolution? He says, I believe in evolution. He told Sterling that. He says, I believe in evolution. Sterling says, no, it's not that. He says, well, is it this thing about the blacks and the priesthood? He says, I think the blacks should have the priesthood. That was before the Kimball edict about the blacks and the priesthood. And, no, he says, that's not it. Well, he says, if you believe in the basic things, you believe in Jesus. He says, no, I don't. He says, I don't believe in the basic things. Well, he says, I don't care. He says, you tell them that if they're going to have a trial for you, I will be the first person to show up and on your behalf. The trial was canceled. And Sterling McMurrin was never tried. So that's a kind of an interesting sideline. Okay, do I keep quiet or do I speak up? And maybe try to help others. Anger management. How do I handle my anger? I think we've mentioned that a little bit. There are a couple of things that help me with my anger management a little bit. One of them is to realize that either there is an afterlife or there isn't. One or the other. Either the lights go out when I die, and that's it. Or there's an afterlife, and I don't know which it is. I used to worry about that, but I don't anymore. Because when you think about it, if there isn't an afterlife, are you going to be angry? You're not going to be angry. Are you going to feel betrayed? You're not going to feel anything. You're not going to be angry. You're not going to feel sad. You're not going to be anything. So why worry about that? That may be a lot better than hell, you know? And if there is an afterlife, then I would hope that there would be a God of truth and a God that says, I'm with you, brother. You look for the truth, and I'm with you. These hypocrites and liars, they're not with me. That would be my hope. But if there is an afterlife, then Joseph Smith and Brigham Young and other church leaders who are responsible for the lying and the immorality and all the rest will receive their judgment. If there's an afterlife and a judgment, they will be judged by a just God, I believe, if there is an afterlife. If there isn't an afterlife, they're done. They're gone. And they have no possible way to take satisfaction in the unbelievable success of their nonsense. It has been unbelievably successful, but they don't know it. They can't. They're gone. So that helps me a little bit. Another thing that helps me, and I'll finish with this, is to try to keep a little sense of humor. And I'd like to mention a couple of things that might be interesting to you. One has to do with stereotypes. I think we're inclined to stereotype people, like women drivers, and there's a stereotyping joke that says, "What do you get when you cross a Mexican and a Mormon? A basement full of stolen food." And there's all kinds of stereotypes, but this story kind of goes to the root of that. There was a pilot flying a group of vacationers from Chicago to Hawaii. And they were flying along, and before they got to L.A., the co-pilot got violently ill. I mean, he was really in trouble. So they landed at the LAX, and they took him off the plane and put a new co-pilot on. Well, the new co-pilot was a Chinese co-pilot. So they took off for Hawaii, and the pilot turns to this Chinese co-pilot, and he says, "I hate you, Japs." The guy says, "Why? What are you talking about?" He says, "For what you did at Pearl Harbor." The Chinese says, "I'm not a Jap." He said, "I'm not Japanese, I'm Chinese. And we had nothing to do with Pearl Harbor." The pilot says, "Well, Japanese, Chinese, Vietnamese, you're all alike." He said, "It doesn't matter to me, you're all alike." So they went on for a few more minutes, and the co-pilot turned to the pilot, and he says, "You're Jewish, aren't you?" He says, "Yeah, how did you know?" "Well," he says, "I can tell." He says, "I hate Jews." "You hate Jews?" Yeah, I sure do." "Why? Why do you hate Jews?" "Because you sunk the Titanic." "We didn't sink the Titanic. That was an iceberg." "Well," he says, "Goldberg, Steinberg, iceberg, you're all alike." This guy said to me the other day, he says, "Sometimes I can't take it anymore." He says, "I just want to run away." He says, "I've had it." I says, I just want to run away. But then he says, "When I start thinking that way, I think about my wife and my kids. Why should I make them happy?" Well, I guess that's it. Anyway, try to keep a sense of humor. It makes life a lot better and makes the anger a little less. If you have any questions, I'll try and answer them. Yes. Yeah, Indy. Yeah.
But have you ever thought to research, like, for instance, the flying and the lost for children who are missing? Is there a large percentage of girls in the community that 12 to 14 years old?
I really don't know. The statistics I got on bankruptcy, Utah led the nation in bankruptcy. And I think I have some ideas why. But, okay, you got paying 10% to the church. You got trying to send out a missionary. You got people going into pyramid schemes, all kinds of stuff like that. I don't know. I don't know about that. Does anyone else? I don't know the answer to that. Yes. Let me just give a reaction to that. Last year at this conference, I heard something that I haven't tried yet, but he said that his brother, that he left the church and his brother came to him, and he talked to his mother. And his mother was just crying, how come you know, we won't be together as a family and all the rest of this. She was just heartbroken because he left the church. And he said to her, Mom, he says, I don't want to go to hell. He says, if I'm wrong, I want you to tell me where I'm wrong. He says, I'd like you to check out the things that I've told you I have a problem with. Okay? The authenticity of the Book of Mormon, the polygamy, et cetera, et cetera. You know, I'd like you to check those out and straighten me out. I'm your son, you know. You love me that much, don't you? He says his mother came back to him in 6 months and she said, I'm getting out too. So then his brother came to him. I kind of got ahead of my story and said, and almost had a fight, a fist fight. Said, you've influenced our mother to get out of the church and now the whole family is lost. And, he says, well, he said the same thing to his brother. He says, I don't know. And he says, I know you love me as a brother. And he says, if I'm wrong, I'd like you to tell me where I'm wrong. And did the same thing. 6 months later, his brother was out. Now, I don't know if that works or not. I have never had the guts to try it, I guess. But anyway, that's an idea. Any other comments or questions there? Yes. Actually, my book took me about 20 years to write. Believe it or not, there were 600 references in that book. If you want to know where it says in the Journal of Discourses that Brigham Young was marrying young girls to old grandpas, it's in there. If you want to know where he said, I'm not a prophet, I've never had a revelation, it's in there. If you want to know where he admitted that he didn't keep the word of wisdom and he had never paid tithing, it's in there. If you want to find out where it talks about Adam God or the blood atonement, it's in there. So you don't have to read 26 volumes of the Journal of Discourse. I've done it for you. But anyway, it took me 20 years to write that book, and there's over 600 references, and they're all authentic. I've never had anybody say, this isn't where this goes. You know, you haven't quoted this correctly. So then I decided to, up until the time I published it, I was, I guess, technically a heretic. Publishing my book made me an apostate. So I got a phone call from the stake president, and he says we need to talk. 03. What? 03. It was in November of 03. And I said, no, President. I said, we don't need to talk. We haven't got anything to talk about. He says, well, I want to talk to you about your book. I said, well, that's fine. But I said, I'm not. He said, we're going to have a court for you for writing that book. And so I said, well, you go ahead, but I'm not going to come. I'm not going to play your game. A court of love, if that's what you want to call it, or an excommunication, is not a situation where the high council is a jury, where they can use their own brains to figure out what's going on. The stake president comes up with a recommendation or an order, and they either agree with him or they don't. If they don't agree with him, they probably won't be high counselor very much longer. So it's not a vote. They don't take a vote. And I said, I'm not going to play your game. If you want to excommunicate me, go ahead. So then they called up my wife, who to this day is still active in the church. And they called her in. And I think what they wanted to know if they needed to kick her out too. Actually, I typed every word of that book myself. She's a secretary. She didn't help me at all. And I did that purposely so she could say that she had nothing to do with it. And so they decided not to kick her out, but, they gave her all this, the family thing, you're ruining the eternity, you know, and all this kind of stuff. Well, that's a bunch of bull too, because she and I weren't married for eternity. I was married to my first wife for 13 years, and that's an eternity. It ended after 13 years. But interestingly, Joseph Smith ridiculed, and that's in my book too, eternal marriage. They called it spiritual wifeism. He said, nothing can be eternal that has a beginning. He took off his ring, and he said, this ring has no beginning or no end. There's an example of eternity. He says, anything that has a beginning will have an end. My eternal marriage had a beginning. We were married in the Salt Lake Temple by Hugh B. Brown. And so it had a date, didn't it, when we were married? So what's it going to have, according to Joseph Smith? An end. There's no such thing as eternal marriage, according to Joseph Smith. But anyway, my second wife was sealed to a man, and he dropped dead of an aneurysm. And so when we started going together, I was still somewhat of a believer, and I didn't want to marry her because she was sealed to another man, and I couldn't have her in the next world and all that stuff. But then we fell in love, and after we were married, we had a son. And this bothered me because I thought, who does this son go with in the next world, right? Me or her and her first husband, who she's sealed to. So I went to the bishop. He says, I have no idea. I went to the stake president. He says, I have no idea. But he says, I know who does. He says, oh, Leslie Stone, a general authority back then, who was over all of the temples. He taught the temple presidents and the matrons, and he was in charge of the temple work for the church. He said, oh, Leslie Stone is coming to our stake for stake conference in 2 weeks. He says, I will make an appointment for you to talk to old Leslie Stone, and he will give you the answer to that question. So we went in 2 weeks, and I sat across the desk from old Leslie Stone. I said, Elder Stone, they like to be called Elder, you know. I said, Elder Stone, I said, I have a question for you. What does it mean to be sealed to somebody? Does it mean that you're going to live next door to them in the next world? Does it mean there's some kind of a pecking order that you have to get permission to do this or that or go create your own world or something from someone over you? Is there a pecking order in the family or something? Does it mean that you have to love them more than you love anyone else because you're sealed to them? He looked me straight in the eye. Now, this is the man who's over all the temples of the church. He looked me straight in the eye and said, I haven't got the slightest idea what it means to be sealed to someone. Either a husband or wife and children, either one. He says, I have no idea what it means. Oh my gosh. That was just one of the drops in my bucket. And I thought, oh my gosh, this guy doesn't know. Anyway, and that little story.